Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. In a moment, the Israeli offensive in northern Gaza intensifies. That's our top story today. Also in the programme, the prison diary of the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, in which he foretold his death. And as gun rights groups gather in Pennsylvania, we'll debate what impact, if any, the issue is having on the US presidential race. The Democratic Party, Kamala Harris, recently sought to reassure voters she favours more gun controls without wanting to take away everyone's guns.
I think for far too long on the issue of gun violence, some people have been pushing a really false choice to suggest you're either in favour of the Second Amendment or you want to take everyone's guns away. I'm in favour of the Second Amendment. And I'm in favor of assault weapons bans, universal background checks, red flag laws. And these are just common sense.
We'll discuss the gun control debate in the US presidential election later in this edition of NewsHour. But first, Israel's current offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon has tended to obscure Israel's ongoing operation in Gaza, aimed at destroying Hamas, and now in its second year. It's a goal that has involved the Israeli military coming back to the same areas repeatedly in new offensives or to where Hamas has become resurgent or regrouped. Over the past week, the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza has been one such location, and now the medical charity MSF say Israeli bombardments there are turning neighbourhoods into uninhabitable ruins. Well, the World Food Programme says no food has been able to enter northern Gaza since October the 1st. The Hamas-run health ministry says 49 Palestinians have been killed in the north in the past 24 hours. Mahmoud Bassai is a spokesperson for Gaza's civil defence.
This is a new massacre to add to the massacres of the Israeli occupation. And the Israeli army targets several homes in the Jabalia al-Balad area. These homes belong to the Asaf and Darduna families and more than one family in this densely populated residential area.
Well, there are still 400,000 Palestinian civilians in northern Gaza, according to the United Nations. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, reports now on the latest developments and a plan devised by retired Israeli generals to force the population there into the south.
We've managed to get to a vantage point overlooking the northernmost parts of northern Gaza, Bet Lachia, Beit Hanun, going down towards Jabalia camp. And in the sort of, I guess, about 10 minutes since we arrived, there's a lot of shelling, airstrikes. I don't know exactly what they are, but it's very intense going on there. There are plumes of smoke going into the air, and even with the naked eye, you can see that the area is absolutely devastated. But Israel has upped the military pressure on northern Gaza once again. Just a few miles away, on the other side of the wall in Gaza, is Jabalia camp, where Palestinian families were fleeing on the orders of the Israeli army. Some of them were hit by bullets.
They told us we have 5 minutes to leave the Fallujah school. Where do we go? In southern Gaza, there are assassinations. In western Gaza, they're shelling people. Where do we go? Oh God, God is our only chance.
Go left and drive slowly down.
It is really hard to get close to Gaza, of course. We can't get in there. The Israelis don't allow journalists in except with the army in very restrictive circumstances. But somehow we've managed to get to the area's checkpoint, which is closed right now. In the watchtowers, there are bullet holes. You can see that from, I presume, from October the 7th last year, when this area was attacked. We're driving now along the security fence. Barbed wire, chain link fencing, concrete wall in the distance. Now, just probably a mile or so from here, and I know it's about that distance because I've been through so many times into Gaza. It's where there used to be very bustling communities, places now where the Israelis are doing a, by all accounts, major military operation. Of course, they're working in virtual privacy there, secrecy. They're moving, they say, after elements of Hamas, but of course there are terrible things happening to the civilian population who've already lived under massive pressure for a year.
It's been apparent for some time that this has been a deliberate and systematic attempt to present an existential threat to the Palestinians, particularly in the north of Gaza.
Liz Alcock is head of protection at Medical Aid for Palestinians, and she has just come back from Gaza.
By making life unlivable, but also at the same time, whilst issuing these forced displacement orders, then when people try to flee, the direct targeting of those people whilst they're under the impression that they will be provided safe passage.
What evidence do you have that they're directly targeted? It's a war zone. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff flying around.
When we're receiving patients in hospitals, a large number of those women and children and people of, if you like, non-combatant age, receiving direct shots to the head, to the spine, to the limbs. Very indicative of a direct targeted attack.
At the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, the director, Hossam Abu Safia, is posting daily updates from his intensive care unit. It is filled with wounded children on ventilators. He says Israel is blocking fuel deliveries for his generator and bringing the hospital and its patients close to catastrophe. On Israeli TV, Giora Island, a retired general, launched an idea that he believes can finally deliver victory to Israel and Gaza. It's known as the General's Plan, and there are signs that the Israeli military is implementing at least part of it in northern Gaza. His idea, tell civilians to leave if they don't impose a state of siege, no food or water, and treat everyone left as a legitimate target.
Since we already encircled the northern part of Gaza in the past 9 or 10 months, what we should do is the following thing, to tell all the 300,000 residents that should be given, I don't know, 10 days to leave through safe corridors that Israel will provide. And after that time, all this area will become to be a military zone. And all the Hamas people, whether some of them are fighters, some of them are civilians, they will have two choices, either to surrender or to starve.
Shalom and welcome to the restoration site of the battles at Yad Mordechai during the Independence War in 1948.
There's an Israeli flag fluttering on the flagpole next to me, and it's over a memorial to a battle when Israelis fought for their independence and the country was invaded by Arab armies. They also fought against Palestinian militias, and the battle here was against an advancing Egyptian army that was trying essentially to destroy the new state at birth. It was a significant battle in what led to Israel's victory, its independence. Palestinians call it the catastrophe. The reason why I'm here is because it's a reminder that all those years after 1948, they're still fighting about who controls this territory effectively. And I can hear airstrikes coming out of Gaza a mile from here. They fought in 1948. They're fighting in 2024. It's a sign of the intractability of this unresolved conflict and a reminder of how it will continue to create and radiate violence until there's some kind of a settlement.
That report by our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. And let's go to Lebanon now, where Hezbollah says it's launched missiles at an Israeli military base after warning residents to stay away from military sites in northern Israel. For its part, the Israeli army has told residents of southern Lebanon not to return to their homes as its offensive continues. The BBC's Jonathan Head joins us now from Beirut. And Jonathan, both sides are digging in.
Definitely, Julian. I mean, it's quiet here in this part of Beirut. We had these devastating airstrikes just 2 days ago, really only about a kilometre away from where I am. But the Israeli airstrikes continue right across Lebanon, at least across the southern part of it, not just in the deep south of Lebanon, where it now has thousands of troops fighting Hezbollah as well. We weren't aware of any in the suburbs of Beirut overnight, but they've been pretty sustained in the last 3 weeks, and in the Bekaa Valley as well. Yesterday, the Lebanese government recorded 57 airstrikes, killing at least 60 people. That's a normal day. When you get up close, you know, you have these ghastly sights of pulverized buildings. Victims covered in ash, you know, screaming ambulances. This is a daily occurrence. It's not going to stop. Hezbollah so far has not been able to launch the kind of devastating attacks people thought they might be able to. We're not sure whether it's holding back or whether its ability to do so has been significantly damaged by these sustained Israeli airstrikes. But they are making these warnings, similar to the ones that Israel gives, telling Israelis in the north of the country to stay away from any kind of military base or risk becoming a target. We're getting constant warnings to evacuate from Israeli Defense Force in different neighborhoods in Lebanon, often very short warnings, and in some cases, like the attack we saw in Beirut 2 days ago, no warning at all.
And the Speaker of Iran's parliament, Iran, of course, being Hezbollah's principal backer, has been in Beirut today.
Yes, he apparently flew himself in. I guess he's a qualified pilot, and maybe a sign of confidence. He's on his way to a big parliamentary meeting in Geneva, has stopped off. I really think this is a public relations exercise. Mohammad Bakr Ghalibaf is a senior figure in the Iranian hierarchy, with the Iranian foreign minister here just 7-8 days ago. You know, some people have questioned here why Iran is not doing more to respond to these devastating Israeli attacks, which are having such an impact on Hezbollah. And I think this is to show their solidarity. And indeed, from the moment he landed, he met the Lebanese prime minister, but was almost immediately whisked off by two Hezbollah MPs to one of those locations near where we are now, which was hit on Thursday, so he could be there among the rubble and show, as he said, to express our solidarity and support for the Lebanese people. I think there are Lebanese, of course, who really question Iran and Hezbollah's agenda and are quite angry that they've been sucked into this dreadful conflict. There'll be others, of course, who will welcome Iran's support but want more.
Jonathan, many thanks. That was the BBC's Jonathan Head speaking from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, an ambitious plan to cut food packaging waste by using the skins of a very common vegetable.
Any meal that you have, there's bound to be some onion in there. Onions are like a global staple for a lot of cuisines. They're everywhere, so their waste is everywhere too.
And a reminder of our main news headlines this hour. UN aid workers say food hasn't been able to enter the north of the Gaza Strip since the beginning of this month because of an intense Israeli offensive. Hezbollah has launched missiles at an Israeli base after warning Israelis to stay away from military sites. And China has announced further plans to significantly increase government debt in order to stimulate its flagging economy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. And there's been a cautious welcome from analysts to China's announcement today of a fresh fiscal stimulus to revive its ailing economy. At a highly anticipated news conference in Beijing, the government announced that it would issue special bonds to boost the capital available to banks. Vice Minister for Finance Liao Min said the bonds would also be used to help debt-ridden local governments.
This policy will not only adjust the supply and demand relationship of land, reduce idle land, and enhance the ability to regulate land supply, but also help ease liquidity and debt pressures on local governments and real estate companies.
Well, the moves add to a series of measures unveiled in recent weeks that have included interest rate cuts and liquidity injections for banks, all aimed at kickstarting China's dragging economy. I've been speaking to Alicia Garcia Herrero, a chief Asia-Pacific economist at Hong Kong's Natixis Bank.
We know there will be special bonds. We've known it for a while since they started with this stimulus on the 24th of September. But the problem is we don't know how many bonds they want to issue, or more importantly, what's the value of bonds. In other words, how much do they want to stimulate the economy with the fiscal expansion?
I mean, does it matter how much?
Yeah, very much. Why does it matter? Because, first of all, we know there is immediate things they need to do. One is to recapitalize the banks. They have even said that at the press conference. So it means probably the situation of Chinese banks is quite serious. And you need to know how much you need for this bank to be solvent. They have also announced that they will buy unsold housing units, meaning those that they built. So basically the excess supply of housing in China that is behind the still falling prices, and they want to clean it up because that will be the only way for the sector to do better in the future, the housing market. And that, again, you need a number. How much does it cost to buy these unsold units from the developers?
I mean, the Chinese government must know how much it needs to spend. What virtue is there in actually concealing the actual number?
Because there's something called public debt. We know that in Europe, you know, there is a limit to how much you can push your fiscal deficit, and you need to finance it. It's a burden for the future because you need to pay interest on the debt. So, you know, they are trying to do this as cheaply, quote unquote, as possible. And that's why I think we have this divide. They're reluctant to announce more. The market wants more. That's where we are.
So, you think it unlikely, therefore, that these measures, the stimulus package, will increase investor confidence?
The first attempt was successful, meaning the central bank governor saying, look, I'm going to create a fund to buy stocks. But that's obviously successful because you're giving money to buy stocks. So, you know, people will buy stocks and expecting an ever-increasing value of stocks. So that's easy. The central bank cut interest rates. Well, of course, everybody cheers until last Monday. On Monday, everybody was waiting at this NDRC's press conference for the number, the fiscal stimulus. Guess what happened? Nothing. Were they ready to share a number? Not yet, because they've not decided it. I mean, there's a lot of different views about this, and this is exactly why they haven't really stimulated the economy for so many years, since COVID. And this is because ideologically, I think there's this idea that stimulus might be very costly for China because China is already very indebted.
I mean, is China's dragging economy dragging the global economy down as well?
Not yet, because we have this ultra-powerful U.S. economy. The emerging world, especially the rest of Asia, has been doing quite well. So, you know, these are sources of growth. And let's not exaggerate here. China has been growing at around 5%, which is not zero. Now, the problem is, what's the next step? What will China increase that growth rate? Very unlikely. With the stimulus, maybe temporarily, but China is bound for structural deceleration.
That was Alicia Garcia Herrero, chief Asia-Pacific economist at Hong Kong's Natixis Bank. Spanish scientists say they've settled the uncertainty over the final resting place of Christopher Columbus, the explorer who opened the Americas for European conquest. They used new DNA technology to compare the remains in his tomb in Seville Cathedral to known relatives, confirming they're genuine. Later today, the scientists will reveal another finding on the origins of Columbus, who's traditionally thought to have been from the Italian city of Genoa. Joined now from Madrid by the BBC's Guy Hedgeco. And Guy, why was there ever any doubt as to where Christopher Columbus was buried?
Well, the doubt is simply because of the fact that his past is relatively shadowy. We don't know every detail about his biography. So there's this long-standing theory that he was born in Genoa. We know that he died in the northern Spanish city of Valladolid in 1506. But between those two facts, we don't know... if indeed he was born in Genoa, and we don't know that either. But between those two facts, we don't know a great deal about his biography. And so there's been a lot of mystery surrounding Columbus for decades, and historians have argued over whether those remains in Seville were actually his. And they've also, of course, argued over where he was in fact born as well.
Is it known why he was buried in Spain?
Well, you have to take into account the fact that we do know that he was backed by the Spanish crown when he crossed the Atlantic in 1492 and reached America. So he was, if nothing else, an adopted Spaniard. But of course, that doesn't mean he was born in Spain. But it made sense, therefore, according to many, that he should be buried in Seville, in a Spanish city, seeing as he'd received the backing of the Spanish crown, which was so crucial, especially the financial backing for that voyage across to America. So in that sense, it did make sense that he was buried there. But there was this competing claim from the Dominican Republic, which has said all along that it has the remains of Columbus in a mausoleum in Santo Domingo.
So we might know later today where Columbus was born, where he actually came from, and a lot of competing claims about that, and indeed over Columbus's ethnicity.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there have been dozens of claims over the years about where he was from, including that he was from Poland, Scotland, Hungary, Nordic countries. But these researchers have whittled down the possibilities to a short list of eight. And those eight possible places are in Spain and Portugal and Italy. One of the theories is that he was, in fact, Jewish and that he kept that quiet because of the religious Catholic fervency of the Spanish crown at the time. That's one theory. There are other theories that he was from Galicia, northwestern Spain, from Mallorca, and of course also all from Portugal, and then Genoa is the other theory we have.
Guy, many thanks. And of course, all will be revealed later on today. That was the BBC's Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with NewsHour. And one of the biggest challenges facing the environment is plastic waste, a lot of it from food packaging. Well, imagine if some of that packaging and some of the paper and cardboard made from cutting down trees could be replaced by using the skin of one of the world's most commonly eaten vegetables. A small company in the north of Scotland is developing eco-friendly packaging made from onion skin. It's called Howd. Cameron Angus Mackay reports.
Any meal that you have, there's bound to be some onion in there. Onions are like a global staple for a lot of cuisines. They're everywhere, so their waste is everywhere too.
Former textile student Rainika Ramanujam first experimented with onion skins as a source of clothing dye.
When I was working at university, I was working with textiles, thinking about how everything around us is made from something. And upon digging into it a little more, realized that a lot of those things weren't made in the best way or with great materials. When you heat up food in plastic packaging or your water bottles, for example, they leach parts of the chemicals into the food or water that we're drinking.
Originally from India, but Dutch by nationality, Rainika explains houd is the Dutch word for skin. She's working on a cardboard-like material and an alternative to flexible film.
A big conglomerate said, I'd love to see more of this when you can scale it. And I just thought, oh, we're onto something here.
Marie Rappin is the company's chief scientific officer.
The process is pretty simple. We use our onion peels and put them in a mixture that we heat up for a little while, then we let it cool down. Once it's cooled down, depending on the colour we want, we might bleach it or not bleach it. And then we're going to mechanically process it, just to refine it to get this really fine pulp.
The pair hope to launch their first product next year, paper made entirely from outer onion skins. Rainika doesn't just want to find alternatives to plastic. Her sights are also set on replacing paper and cardboard packaging.
Trees are super important to the environment for all the benefits they bring, the animals they home, but also the carbon sequestration that is such a big conversation in the whole net zero space. Onion skins do not have that same responsibility. They are not sequestering carbon. So what we're doing here is by using our paper or our onion skin derived material, you are saving trees.
Houd sources waste peel from farmers. Because of antimicrobial properties, onion peel packaging could help extend the shelf life of perishable foods. Marie's working on a flexible film which could replace plastic bags for food items like spinach.
Something we want to achieve with our film in the future is obviously similar properties than what your spinach bag has. It's transparent, it's nice, it's light, you like to use it. But we also want to add some extra properties which would help elongating the shelf life of fresh produce. So you could keep something in your fridge for extra days.
And the question everyone's asking, do the prototypes smell of onion?
Whenever we are showing prototypes, one of the first things people tend to do is pick up the samples and smell them. They're always convinced that they'll smell like onions, which is a logical conclusion, but we always have to disappoint them. They smell quite bland, if anything, maybe a little sweet.
That report from Cameron Angus Mackay. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. I will spend the rest of my life in prison and die here. There will not be anybody to say goodbye to. All anniversaries will be celebrated without me. I will never see my grandchildren. Well, those prophetic words were written by the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny in March 2022, nearly 2 years before he died in an Arctic penal colony while serving a lengthy prison sentence on charges of extremism. And they're from a memoir which is being published in New York and London 8 months after his death. Natalia Vasilyeva is a Russian journalist who's formerly Moscow, Istanbul and Jerusalem correspondent for the Daily Telegraph newspaper. She joins us now. Not all of this memoir, of course, was written in prison, but it's intriguing why the parts that were managed to get out.
Hi, Julian, and thank you for having me. Yeah, the excerpts that were published this morning came from his prison diary, and most of those entries date back to 2022, 2023, when his prison conditions were still not as horrendous as they became later. So lawyers were able to visit him quite frequently, and those pages were smuggled, or not even smuggled, they were passed on to the lawyers, and it was a legal thing to do. There was nothing untoward about it.
And a lot of the entries are very poignant, such as the one that I've just quoted. I mean, they speak of his intense loneliness.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you've said, some of them were quite prophetic. I came across one entry in which he spoke about what might happen when he dies in prison, not actually if he dies, but when he dies. He talks about what happens if the if prison authorities don't surrender his body to the family. What if he's buried in an unmarked grave, and how horrific it would be for his family not to know where he will rest and not to have a place of burial. And as our listeners might remember, there was quite a bit of a scandal when he died in February, and how long it took for the family to get the body released and to get the authorities' permission to bring it back to Moscow and gave him a proper burial. So yeah, it was prophetic in so many ways. It makes quite a chilling read.
Very poignant, very chilling, but also a lot of defiance. And another quote: "The only thing we should fear is that we will surrender our homeland to be plundered by a gang of liars, thieves, and hypocrites."
Yeah, I mean, when Navalny came back to Russia in January 2021, he knew he was coming back to a sure imprisonment. He didn't know how it would pan out. He obviously had no idea that Russia would invade Ukraine a year later, and his prison conditions would deteriorate even further. His original arrest sparked nationwide protests, and he was not doing it as a martyr just for the sake of it. He was doing it just to show that in a country ruled by a man without principles, he was the one who had values, and he was actually prepared to sacrifice himself for those values. You know, when you talk about the current Russian leadership, and we're talking about Vladimir Putin, we're in a situation when Russia is in the middle of a war, and it keeps incentivizing Russians to fight in Ukraine by paying out massive bonuses, because it is failing to find people to go in Ukraine for free, because obviously no one wants to do it. It's not a righteous war for anyone in Russia.
Natalia, many thanks. That was Russian journalist Natalia Vasilyeva. Well, on Tuesday night, in his nightly video address, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky paid tribute to his soldiers, who in August seized dozens of villages in the Kursk region of Russia. President Zelensky said that with the Kursk operation, the Ukrainians had shown they could take the war into Russia. 2 months later, Moscow says some of the territory has been recaptured. In mid-September, journalist Oz Kartaji, embedded with Ukrainian forces, visited Ukrainian-occupied Sudza, a town in southwestern Kursk. He spoke to my colleague Paul Henley and told him how he managed to get inside the region.
It was actually quite difficult to get in. There has been a real restriction on journalists entering into Kursk. The situation on the ground is very, very difficult. When we were there, the Russians had just launched a new counteroffensive to try and take back the area. They made some pretty sweeping gains in the first 24 hours, but then the operation petered out. But that was it was that 24 hours that we were heading into Kursk. And so one would expect that the Ukrainian forces would be very, very on edge during that period, or, you know, maybe even potentially thinking about retreating. That wasn't the case while we were there. It was very clear the operation was ongoing, that the Ukrainian forces had no intention of leaving. All of the traffic really was going in one direction across the border. The other thing you noticed, really, as soon as you got to Sumy, the oblast on the Ukrainian side before that border, is just how many vehicles had the operational marking for the Kursk operation. That gave you a sort of idea of the scale of how large this operation is by just how many vehicles you saw that were, you know, working the logistics chain, that were traveling across the border in both directions. A very large operation indeed. So from my perspective there, once we got in, it was very clear that the Ukrainians weren't planning on leaving anytime soon. They were definitely planning on staying and holding this territory.
And have they held it? Because, yeah, the Russians say they've reclaimed some of it, don't they?
The Russians have reclaimed some of it, but the vast majority of it is still controlled by the Ukrainians. The Russian counteroffensive to take back all of the Kursk Oblast, it had, as I said, some pretty good successes in the first 24 hours, but after that, the operation seemed to come to falter, and the Ukrainians have basically held everything since then.
Tell us about your conversations with Ukrainians. You talked about troops being upbeat. And did you talk to Russian civilians at all?
So, look, the problem when we were there was that there were drones overhead the entire time. We had a domestically produced drone scanner. So Ukrainians have these 3D printed, completely bespoke electronic wireless drone systems that detect what, not just that there are drones above, but what exactly what type of drones there are. So you know when the Russians have things flying overhead. They were constantly overhead the entire time. So we only had about an hour and a half inside the Kursk region, and it was less safe for civilians to be near us than anything. So we didn't even want to stop to get out of the vehicle to talk to civilians. As to what the Ukrainians were saying, much of it was along the lines of, this is a really difficult environment to operate in. There are drones above us. We can't stay long. You know, this is an incredibly dangerous undertaking. But yes, there was a certain level of upbeatness about them. This operation was a very cunning maneuver, and it has taken the Russians by surprise. And the Ukrainians have not had a good year of the war this year in 2024. So this is one of the few things they can look at and say, we've done something here. We've had some successes here. There is also a lot of anticipation and nervousness about how the operation has been going over the course of the year so far.
That was journalist Oz Kartoji, who went into Russia's Kursk region in September with Ukrainian forces. Chinese communities around the world are being targeted by a particularly cruel crime known as the blessing scam. Female criminals trick older women out of cash and valuables by persuading them their loved ones are threatened by evil spirits. In recent months, there have been a wave of cases reported in the US, Canada, Australia, and now, as Elaine Chong reports, in Britain.
The blessing scam is an elaborate piece of criminal street theatre. There's a well-rehearsed script that's acted out for an audience of one, the unsuspecting victim, like Meng Ni in northwest London.
I was on my way going to yoga. At the traffic lights on Harrow Road, one lady just touched my arm and I jumped, and then she spoke in Cantonese.
The Chinese stranger who stopped Meng Ni on a London street introduced herself as Miss Li. She was crying.
And she says, oh, do you know a Mr. Cole? He's a healer. My husband is very sick and needs his help.
Meng Ni hadn't heard of him, but then a second stranger appeared. She called herself Miss Chan.
Miss Chan said, yeah, I know the way to the healer's home. It's down this way. And she said, you come with me because this lady approached you first.
Meng Ni's yoga plans were abandoned as the women pressured her into going with them. Moments later, they bumped into a third woman who said that she was the healer's granddaughter. After hearing Miss Li's tale of woe, she disappeared around the corner to seek the healer's help. She returned with troubling news. The healer had apparently discovered that Miss Li's husband wasn't the only one in danger. Meng Ni was told she had somehow offended an evil spirit, which now threatened her son's life.
He's going to have an accident and he's going to die immediately. I jumped and I was like in tears. You know, how could something like this? So she put the fear in me.
Meng Ni was told that her son could be protected by a blessing. To make it work, she would need to bring valuables for the ritual, but they would be given back to her afterwards.
Just for prayers, for the blessing. So I thought, there's no harm. You know, I'm not going to lose it.
Accompanied by one of the women, she rushed home to collect her jewellery and lent to the bank to withdraw more than $5,000. It all went into a black plastic bag over which the healer's relative performed a ceremony in the street. But at some point, the bag was secretly switched for another one, which was handed back to Meng Ni.
So when I went straight home, I thought, yeah, let me take out my jewellery. And inside the black bag is just a brick, piece of cake, two bottles of water. And then I just told my son, I said, I think I've been conned, I've been scammed.
If you are struggling to understand how Meng Ni could have been tricked like this and why she placed so much trust in the strangers she had just met, well, so is Meng Ni.
I really cannot tell you why. You know, maybe because they put the fear in me that something is going to happen to my son, and all logical thinking got thrown out. Chinese people are a little bit superstitious in some ways.
Mangni's story is strikingly similar to those of other victims. Even the fictional healer's name is the same in many cases, and police in the US, Canada and Australia have all recently issued warnings about how the scam works. Anqi Shen is a former Chinese police officer who is now a law professor at Northumbria University in the north of England. She says the criminals know that older Chinese people associate certain valuable items with good fortune, and it's those things which victims are told to bring to be blessed.
Chinese people tend to keep some valuable jewelry, especially pieces made of gold, silver, jade, themselves are believed to hold protective powers. So it is often commonly believed that valuable items which have been blessed offer even greater protection.
Meanwhile, Mangni hopes that the law soon catches up with the women who robbed her.
What annoys me a lot as well is these people are conning their own people. And I told the police I'm willing to do anything to catch these people because these people need to be stopped.
Elaine Chong reporting. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall and this is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Open carry in the United States refers to the practice of visibly carrying a firearm in public places. It's allowed with or without a permit in most American states. And the biggest open carry rally in the US, known as the Rod of Iron Ministries, is taking place today in Pennsylvania. The festival draws attendees celebrating the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. Gun control is one of the most contentious issues in US politics. Guns killed more than 48,000 people in 2022. And Mr. Trump himself claimed during the presidential debate with Kamala Harris that she would confiscate everyone's gun if elected. But she replied that she was, in fact, a gun owner, as was her running mate, Tim Walz, and later that she would use her gun if an intruder entered her house. We'll speak to a gun control advocate in a moment. First, let's hear from Amanda Suffikul from Women for Gun Rights, who's going to be hosting a talk at the Rod of Iron Ministries. And Amanda, why do you own a gun?
Well, I own a gun for a variety of reasons, but I was raised by a pro-gun family, so I've always owned a gun, but I've used them for sport, for protection. They're just a tool that we've always had in our household.
And do you believe that there should be any kind of controls on gun ownership?
I do not believe that there should be. I mean, there are so many erosions to our rights, and the Second Amendment is a right that does not have those 27 words in the American Second Amendment do not have restrictions added to them.
What do you want to hear from the presidential candidates when it comes to gun ownership, gun control?
Well, I do not want to hear gun control. And when you listen to some of the platform that is on the left, there is mandatory buyback is one of the terms that they use. And mandatory buyback is just confiscation with some sort of compensation, but it is confiscation nonetheless. And so I'm looking for a constitutional president who will stand with our rights, whether it's the First Amendment or the Second Amendment or as the amendments run through.
I mean, the kind of controls that you are alluding to are, as you say, from the left. They're not from the Democratic presidential candidate, are they?
Well, they're actually from the Democratic platform, so which ergo, that is the Democratic candidate. But the Democratic candidate itself, herself, has said that she is a proponent of mandatory gun buyback. This statement that she now that she owns a gun has been the first statement that she's made in that effort since before she was elected as a senator. And so it's just kind of like that was a little bit out of the far right field.
You're not in any way deterred when it comes to gun ownership and gun control by the high mortality rate in the United States. I quoted that figure of 48,000 people in 2022. And I know, I know it's not the guns, it's the people who own them, etc., etc. But nonetheless, it's an awful lot of people, isn't it?
Well, it is. It really is an aspect of criminal reform. I mean, you need to tear down and look at that data specifically and figure out where it's happening, why it's happening. And that's one of the reasons why Women for Gun Rights and the organization womenforgunrights.org stands for education, not legislation. So anything that we tell people to stay away from, don't know anything about, don't learn anything about, and then all of a sudden when you're an adult, then they're in your arena, it would be like never riding in a car at all, and then one day getting your driver's license.
Okay.
We want to educate first.
Amanda, look, many thanks. Amanda Suffolkill from Women for Gun Rights. And I'm joined now by Dr. Joe Sakram, a surgeon and gun control advocate, since he himself was shot at the age of 17. And Dr. Sakram, I understand that you come across the consequences of gun use in the course of your job.
Yeah, well, look, thanks so much for having me. And as you point out, you know, I am a trauma surgeon at Johns Hopkins, but I also come to this conversation as a survivor of gun violence who, you know, frankly, has seen too many tragedies come through our trauma center. And I can tell you, it's never been more important to address the gun violence epidemic that's devastating families and communities. That's frankly a uniquely American problem. And, you know, I was listening to your guests, and what I will tell you is that this is not, you know, people have tried to kind of couch this as simply a, you know, a criminal justice issue. This is a public health issue, as illustrated recently by the Surgeon General. And there is no one solution or one organization that's going to be able to tackle this problem. It really requires a multifaceted approach. And
But as you heard, you know, from the last speaker, I mean, the way she spoke and the way a lot of American gun owners speak, it seems to be in the DNA of Americans. And that's a very difficult thing to turn around.
Yeah, I agree with you. However, what I would say is that there's a couple important points. The first is that this is not about the Second Amendment. I think people always try to use that, you know, as a way to kind of get around the real issue. This is about responsible gun ownership. And here's the reality is when you look at the majority of Americans, including responsible gun owners, they agree and they are in favor of passing common sense solutions that allow us to make communities safer, whether it's red flag laws or enhancing the
Dr. Sakram.
Brady background checks and so forth. Right. And
sorry, the line keeps on dropping out, but it gives me time to just ask my final question, and I want a very, very brief answer. And which of the two presidential candidates would deliver on the kind of gun controls that you're looking for?
Well, I think in my mind, it's clear that this is Vice President Harris and Governor Waltz. When you look at the Democratic ticket, they have both been champions for gun violence prevention. Harris has spent much of her career working to reduce gun violence and currently leads the White House's first ever office on gun violence prevention. And Governor Waltz has signed monumental gun safety policies during his tenure as the Minnesota governor.
Okay. Dr. Sakram, look, many, many thanks. And apologies about the quality of the connection. Dr. Joe Sakram, a surgeon and gun control advocate. And that's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.